It's Wednesday, June 10th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, a suicide bombing takes place outside an ancient temple in Egypt.
Well, this is clearly an attempt by the radical jihadists in Egypt who are trying to disrupt the tourist industry, which is essential to the economy of Egypt.
What is the best way to counter the Islamic State? We'll have some opinions. New York's new World Trade Center is open for business, and singer Kelly Clarkson has a new song, Invincible. It's all ahead. A suicide bomber blew himself up Wednesday outside the ancient Karnak Temple in Luxor, Egypt, in an attack that left four people wounded. Officials said the attack involved two other people who were killed by police. Graham Bannerman, a scholar at the Middle East Institute, speaks with VOA's Jeffrey Young about the attack.
Mr. Bannerman, what happened in today's attempted attack at Luxor in Egypt?
There was an attack at the Temple of Karnak where terrorists tried to enter the temple and cause an incident there, but they were stopped by policemen at the entrance. One of the terrorists detonated a bomb. He was killed. One of the others was killed. The other was seriously wounded. Two policemen were wounded, as was two civilians, but no tourists were hurt.
Why would this temple in Luxor be a target of an attack? What is the significance of this?
Well, this is clearly an attempt by the radical jihadists in Egypt who are trying to disrupt the tourist industry, which is essential to the economy of Egypt.
Could you explain how it's essential? I mean, how many jobs do you think, what percentage, or I want to get a little bit of quantification. Egypt depends on tourism. How many people in Egypt need tourism in order to make a living?
There are millions of people in Egypt who live in the tourism industry. Most of them are small people who are vendors and people who work off the tourist industry or guides and all sorts of people. And it's very essential to the economy. It brings in a lot of foreign revenue. The Egyptian government in the last year and a half has seen increasing the tourist levels from the low of 2013, but most of those tourists have gone to the beach resorts. It's only recently that you've begun to see increasing numbers of tourists going to the traditional ancient ruins along in the Nile Valley, and Luxor is the central place for that.
I can remember back in slightly earlier times in the 90s and in the early 2000s, when we had these sorts of attacks and incidents in places like Sinai and other parts of Egypt. Of course, now that was directed against Hosni Mubarak. But it's the same story, right? It's an outside group trying to damage the government as much as possible.
There was a serious problem in Egypt in the late 90s with people who had been in Afghanistan as fighters against the Soviet Union who came back to Egypt and started causing all sorts of terrorist incidents. What happened was an event at Luxor in 1997, where they literally attacked at the temple across the river from Karnak and killed over 50 tourists at that temple. The reaction of the Egyptian public to that was such that basically the whole heart and soul was torn out of the opposition movement and they disappeared. I think this is the danger here because most Egyptians support the government of el-Sisi and they support his efforts to improve the economy, and they will see this as a direct attack upon the people of Egypt. And this is one of the reasons why the Muslim Brotherhood has lost much of its popular support.
Well, what I hear in your last answer is that this could backfire on the opposition, that this could actually turn people against the opposition and erode their support. Fair enough?
The problem for the opposition is they cannot be seen as working against the well-being of Egypt, or they will lose popular support. They've already lost a great deal of popular support, and such an incident at Karnak is likely to have a similar erosion of support for them in the public mind.
Graham Bannerman is a scholar at the Middle East Institute in Washington. I'm Jeffrey Young, VOA News.
Thanks very much, Jeffrey. Well, let's take a look now at what's being said about the Luxor attack online. Michael Lippin is here in the studio to give us an update. Michael.
Thank you, Sarah. First, I'd like to draw the attention of our listeners to the Luxor story that we've published on our website. You can find it near the top of our homepage, voanews.com. It has a map showing the location of the attack inside Egypt and also raw footage of the aftermath. You can find that footage at the bottom of the article. I was looking at what people are saying about the attack on Twitter as well, and I've seen some expressions of sympathy for Egypt. One comes from U.S. Twitter user Jihan Mansi, based in Newport Beach, California. She said, "My thoughts and prayers are with the beautiful people of Egypt and the ancient sites." A post by the Reuters news agency linking to its article on the attack also drew a supportive message from Twitter user Steve Otiambo. He replied to the Reuters tweet saying, "Stay strong, Egypt." The Reuters post also generated a bit of debate on the issue. Twitter user Lidar Sagan replied to it saying, "This must be the 1,000th terror bombing by a follower of the Religion of Peace this year. I can't be far off." And that comment appears to be referring to the Religion of Islam. It also prompted a reply from another user, M15T, who said, "That's why we call this extremism. Condemning the entire religion isn't fair." Now, the Twitter world's interest in Luxor has perhaps unsurprisingly jumped in the past day. Analytics website Topsy shows that Luxor has been mentioned 16,000 times, accounting for more than half of all tweets referencing Luxor in the last month. Sarah?
Thanks very much, Michael. Well, speaking of the Middle East and situations elsewhere, at a news conference after the G7 summit in Germany, President Barack Obama acknowledged that the U.S. did not have a complete strategy to counter the Islamic State militant group. We're joined now by VOA senior Middle East reporter Mohammed El-Shenawy, who spoke to several top regional analysts about the subject. Mohammed, what did you find?
Sarah, experts and former U.S. officials are taking a real hard look at what is missing in that strategy to combat the so-called Islamic State. For example, Stephen Hadley, former U.S. National Security Advisor and the co-chair of the newly established Atlantic Council's Middle East Strategy Task Force, says the success of any strategy depends on local ownership.
U.S. policy has had a recognition that it is the people of the Middle East in the end of the day who have to defeat ISIS, and that they do see it as a threat, and they are worthy of our support as they try to remove the scourge of ISIS from their land.
Actually, Hadley says from the very beginning, the United States indicated that the region needs to lead, and the U.S. tried to put together a coalition of countries in that region who are united by their appreciation of the threat that ISIS poses to the future of the entire Middle East. As for Francis Riccardoni, a former U.S. ambassador to Egypt, he recalls President Obama's first speech on ISIS, in which he called for a comprehensive approach to address the causes as well as the symptoms, rather than just relying on military force.
Defeating and crushing them is not going to resolve the problem in the long run. They come from something. They come from the failure of the Syrian state and weaknesses of the Iraqi state in taking care of all of its citizens. Those things need to be addressed. So issues of governance and service by the state to the people, it seems to me, are paramount.
So, Mohammed, is it not American boots on the ground that can help eradicate the threat of the Islamic State?
Actually, Zoghbi surveys of the Arab public opinion showed several times that a majority of Arabs do not support a U.S.-led military strikes against ISIS, even though they know for sure it is a dangerous extremist group. Zoghbi, president of the Arab American Institute, explains what he said.
They've lost confidence in the ability of the U.S. to use force and use it responsibly. Iraq was a terrible toll on the Arab psyche. And the behavior on Israel-Palestine has also had an impact. So simply knowing that the Arabs are afraid of ISIS doesn't translate immediately to America should lead a military attack against ISIS.
Sarah, also Zoghbi added that when Arabs see the U.S. siding with Iran on one side and with a government in Iraq that doesn't bring in all segments of the population, attacking ISIS makes it stronger if the U.S. does it with the wrong allies, as he said.
All right, well, thanks very much, Mohammed. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute. NASA was partially successful with the recent test of its low-density supersonic decelerator, or LDSD. The flying saucer-shaped vehicle was designed to test new technologies to help the space agency land bigger and heavier spacecraft on planets such as Mars. After being carried by a balloon to an altitude of about 36 kilometers, the vehicle was released and its rocket took it higher.
Ignition confirmed. Recording.
To nearly 55 kilometers. To test a landing, the LDSD then successfully deployed its donut-shaped airbag and its enormous supersonic parachute.
BT2 detected.
But the parachute shredded into pieces shortly after opening, disappointing mission control. The recent test flight of the LDSD was the second of three scheduled test flights. Its final test is scheduled for next summer. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, singer Kelly Clarkson wants to prove she's invincible. The weeks and months following the September 11, 2001 attacks on the World Trade Center were a dark time for New Yorkers who wondered if the city they loved would ever rebound. However, in November, after 13 years, $3 billion, and forests of red tape, the new World Trade Center Tower, unofficially called Freedom Tower, opened to tenants and opened to the public on May 29th. At 541 meters tall, it's the highest building in the Western Hemisphere. Well, we've got a very dazzled Adam Phillips on the phone from the observation area at the pinnacle to talk with us about it. Hello, Adam. What's it like up there?
Well, it's unbelievably beautiful. I mean, you said dazzled. That doesn't even begin to say. I'm looking out. I feel like I'm in an airplane, except it's stationary, and I'm looking out at the Empire State Building and the Chrysler Building and hectares and hectares of water in the Hudson River and the ocean, and it's just really just jaw-droppingly beautiful and amazing and inspiring to see it here on this place where, you know, the World Trade Center towers once stood.
Right. Well, I hope you're not scared of heights anyway, but what does it cost to get up there?
It's $32 for $32 for adults, and it's $26 for children. So it's a little bit of a hefty price tag, but I think that, you know, people want to do it. People were lined up around the block to come in, and I guess they think it's worth it. There's other features here too. There's a movie to watch about New York life. There's tour guides. There's a great restaurant. All kinds of good stuff to do once you're here. But it goes into your pocket a little bit for sure.
Yeah, but, tourists are usually willing to pay. Look what they pay to go to Disney World or Disneyland, that kind of
exactly.
thing.
Exactly.
Well, is there anything special about the building other than its height?
Well, I mean, there was a long, long trade-off in conversations and some acrimony, actually, between the people who wanted it to be aesthetic and the symbolic structure and those who wanted to make sure that it was very secure, that it would be good as a building, and that, of course, it wouldn't fall to another terrorist attack again. So it's sort of a twisting, structure to the whole thing, which makes it look really, really beautiful. But hidden inside that is all kinds of concrete fortifications, and it's also a very sustainable building because they were very, very careful to make sure that it was green. There's all kinds of solar and wind power here, and the windows are made of a special glass to make sure that sun comes in, and it actually dims the lights in here when it is sunny outside, which it is now. Couldn't have a better day for this.
Yeah, I'm sure. It sounds great. Well, I understand there was a lot of controversy about the design of the building and a lot of politics as well.
Yes, there was. I mean, it went through a lot of different administrations of the governor. The actual land is owned by the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey, which is a very complicated political outfit. And what was going to go on here and who was going to get how much rent and how tall it was going to be and what it was going to be called, how much of a memorial it would be and how much of an office building it would be. We went back and forth for a long time. So it was actually about 9 years before they really started digging in to the foundation.
Yeah, it did take a long time. But anyway, thanks very much, Adam.
It's great. Hello from the birds, too.
Okay, that's Adam Phillips reporting from the top of the World Trade Center. This is VOA.
Hashtag VOA. It's a weekly show, Tuesdays at 1730 UTC, where we bring you the top topics of the week. But the show lives on social media every day with your daily video shorts, What's Trending Wednesday, and the Friday Fast Five. Subscribe to the show at YouTube. You can find us at hashtag VOA. You can reach me at Twitter, at Perry Cal, or talk to the show anytime. Please don't forget to like us on Facebook. We like to be liked. We love to be seen. And you can reach us anytime.
Hi, my name's Larry London. Welcome to Border Crossings, your request and dedication program here at the Voice of America. 1500 Universal, Monday through Friday, we're there for an hour playing your favorite music. You can send an email in and request your favorite songs by your favorite artists. You can also phone in as well. We have great contests and surprise guests from time to time. Border Crossings, every single day during the week at 1500 Universal, here on the Voice of America.
American singer Kelly Clarkson is making news again, proving she's got staying power. In fact, you might even say she's invincible. Here's VOA's David Byrd and Larry London to explain.
She won the very first American Idol, and now Kelly Clarkson has a new song that's climbing the charts. It's called Invincible. It's from her new CD, Piece by Piece, and Larry London joins me to talk about this tune. Larry,
well,
this is a... Another anthem from Kelly Clarkson, I guess.
She's very good at creating music that people can relate to and connect with, and that's one of the keys to her success over the years. And the new album is great, Piece by Piece. She took an off-road for a little bit, did some country music, but she's kind of back in the main lane of the pop world and just finished off with a Heartbeat song, which was her 16th Top 40 single. And so the new song, Invincible, as you mentioned, It's an inspirational song. It's a very happy, positive song. And Kelly's in a very positive place right now, despite all of the criticism that she's been undergoing recently because of her weight gain. And so she's okay. She's happy with herself. She said, I love myself, and I am invincible, which is what this song kind of reflects and represents.
You know I was broke down. I hit the ground. I was crying now. I couldn't make no sound. No one hears the silent tears. You know I had lost hope, I was all alone, never been so low, till you came along, teacher, I feel the dots connected.
Now she had a baby, right? That's
yeah.
Why she had some weight gain.
Well, she's always battled weight. That's been a problem that she's dealt with her entire life. She admits openly that the weight issues have always been troublesome for her. She did drop a few pounds a number of years ago, but since the baby, since the birth of River Rose, it has not been a very easy thing for her to get rid of the weight. But she's happy with herself, as she said. In fact, she said after she finishes her current tour, she's going to try and get pregnant again. She wants to have another baby by the end of this year. She wants to be pregnant.
And this song talks about, you know, issues like overcoming abuse. The video for it has different women in different scenarios. One woman is in a wheelchair. One woman is like in an abusive situation, you know, and it's different ethnicities, different races, et cetera. And is Kelly trying to broaden her appeal with the video, or what exactly is she doing there?
Well, that's an interesting question, David. Kelly, you know, currently appeals to quite a diverse group of people to begin with. They all like her and relate to her. She's a person who's overcome a number of obstacles, as we mentioned a little while ago. She grew up in a very small town in Texas, and they weren't very wealthy. Mom was an English teacher. And so, you know, she's considers herself to be the average kind of person. She doesn't look at herself as a star. She thinks her music is very relatable, and she's very reachable. She's very reachable. She's not kind of up on a perch or anything like that. She wants to be an everybody's person, and I think she comes across that way. You really like Kelly. She's genuine with everything she does. 25 million sales. She's won so many awards, including 12 Billboard Music Awards. So, you know, she's got the appeal that is necessary to make it in the music business these days. And the new song is doing very well. She performed it for the first time on television at the Billboard Award Show.
All right. That's VOA's Larry London. We'd love to hear what you think about this. You can go on to our Facebook page. That's VOA Music. It's facebook.com/VOA-music. You can leave your comments there. Larry also hosts VOA's Border Crossings, which has its own Facebook page. You can contact him there. Maybe he'll play Kelly Clarkson's Invincible.
We'd love to do it.
That is the music of Kelly Clarkson, and she's singing about feeling invincible. Well, if you'd like to listen to today's program again or any previous broadcast, you can visit our website at voanews.com. Go to the Programs tab in the upper right-hand corner, then scroll down to International Edition. There's also a range of stories and web pieces you might like to read about on all types of subjects from all over the world. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Addressing climate change is a key priority for the Obama administration. And so it is no surprise that U.S. global leadership on climate extends to one of the most fragile regions in the world, the Arctic. As the new chair of the Arctic Council, the United States has made cooperation to reduce emissions, protection of communities from the impacts of climate change, and the building of foundational climate science key pillars of its agenda. Every nation that cares about the future of the Arctic has to be a leader in taking and urging others to move forward with bold initiatives and immediate, ambitious steps to curb the impact of greenhouse gases, said Secretary of State John Kerry at a reception for the Arctic Council that he recently hosted in Washington, D.C. The Arctic Council has a responsibility to the people who live in the region. As beautiful as it is not just a picturesque landscape. It's a home. It's a lifestyle, said Secretary of State Kerry. Our priorities include Arctic Ocean safety, security, and stewardship. This includes improving economic and living conditions of the inhabitants of Arctic communities. That is a critical concern, indigenous population and what development or changes in the environment might do to those folks, said Mr. Kerry.
Over the next years, we're going to focus on the well-being of the indigenous communities, and we're going to take into account that the melting of the ice is now opening up the possibilities of a great deal more commercial traffic, a great deal more tourism, ecotourism or otherwise, and a great deal more shipping, fishing, and commercial operations, particularly possibility of extraction of minerals from the ocean.
We want a region where people can live with hope and optimism for the future, where strong measures are being taken to mitigate environmental harm, where natural resources are managed effectively and sustainably, and where the challenges of economic development and social cohesion are being addressed in a creative, sensitive, responsible way, said Secretary of State Kerry. Above all, we want a region where every stakeholder has a voice and a role in making the idea of one Arctic a reality.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at voanews.com/editorials.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's premier newsmaker interview program. If you have ideas for guests or topics, or want to comment on one of our programs, please write to us at Press Conference USA, Voice of America, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. That's Press Conference USA, Voice of America, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. Or if you have access to the internet, send us an email to pcusa@voanews.com. Once again, our email address is PCUSA at voanews.com. We look forward to hearing from you.